This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
This is probably the one sports-related book I will read this year, but it was worth it. Particularly with these athletes you talk about, it's amazing the almost gap between their low point and being the best in the world because they start off with these sort of disadvantages against them.
In other words, his friends were out partying and were wearing nice clothing sometimes on Saturday night. They were going out and they would make fun of him. Oh, Serge, you're too poor to come out with us. And he could have gone out with them. And he liked girls and everything, all that kind of stuff. But he said, no, that stuff will be there for me later. And I'm not advocating, you know, abstinence until later. But I'm suggesting that...
Gotta be a superstar before you fool around with girls.
Exactly.
So Greg Zuckerman, from best-selling author from The Wall Street Journal, author of Frackers, the greatest, also author of The Greatest Trade Ever, and now the very new Rising Above, How 11 Super Athletes Overcame Challenges in Their Youth to Become Superstars. Greg, welcome to the podcast. Again, this is the second time you're on the podcast.
Great to be here. I love your work, everything you do, from online to podcast, everywhere. So it's a real pleasure to be here.
You were my first guest 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. And again, I love everything you do. So it's great to be back.
Yeah, thanks so much. And also, I once again want to mention, thank you for including me in your first book, The Greatest Trade Ever. Although it was embarrassing for me. I was the one guy who refused to invest in John Paulson right before he returned 600% in a year.
So, yes, there are lessons to learn from even the mistakes of really smart people.
Well, I'm not so sure. Lessons to learn from stupid people, too. So, Rising Above, How 11 Athletes Overcame Challenges. Some of these athletes, I mean, you talk about LeBron James. All these athletes that you mentioned are like superstars. One of them had Tourette syndrome. Another one was missing a hand. Someone like LeBron James had moved from home to home to home because he was in this broken family. I mean, I think his mother was like 14 when she had him.
A little older, but yeah, very young.
Yeah, and he had to move out of her house for a while she kind of found her bearings. And he had a very difficult childhood. And you talk about how he overcame that to become basically the greatest basketball player probably of all time. But you actually have many basketball players here who are kind of the best in their specialties and how they kind of overcame severe difficulties and early childhood trauma to get there. But I want to ask first, this book feels different than your first two books, which were more almost investigative journalism, more where you kind of embedded yourselves in the lives of the people you wrote about. Tell me about, this felt like a passion project for you, and the style even is a little bit different. Tell me about the writing of this book and why and so on.
Sure. So it is very different. I've written this with my two sons, and they were the impetus in some ways. My youngest son is 14, and he was born with two fingers on his left hand. And despite that, he is a superstar, a ball player in our town. He's the goalie of the travel soccer team and is a big baseball player and such. And it was his idea, really, to examine things that people have overcome in sports and to say, well, maybe there's some lessons here for other people. And I really got excited about it. And my other son is just sort of a bookworm and wanted to be involved in the project. And it is our view that everyone has a difference in some ways. You know, maybe not as dramatic as some of the people we write about, and maybe they haven't achieved the kind of acclaim that these people have. But in some ways, everyone feels different. Everyone's got a difference. And to learn from some of the accomplishments and what they've overcome and how they did it, I thought it would be really important, and both for young people and for all other people as well, but especially for young people dealing with their own stuff. And every young person has their own stuff to deal with. So yeah, we set out to write a story, write a book. And the key to the book to me is that each of these stars had a different kind of challenge. So it's not just sort of the cliched, okay, their father walked out. You know, that'll happen often in sports. But sometimes there are physical differences. Sometimes it's emotional. Sometimes it's health. Like you mentioned, Tim Howard had both Tourette syndrome and OCD. So that's what we tried to do, pick out superstars who each overcame something different, some challenge.
And I think, so a lot of this podcast has been about peak performance. Like I bring on either people who have achieved enormous success, like even world level success in their areas, or writers and researchers have studied it. And particularly with these athletes you talk about, it's amazing the almost gap between their low point and being the best in the world because they start off with these sort of disadvantages against them. But you make the very interesting point that all of us, to some extent, have disadvantages. These are just sort of obvious ones, like Tourette syndrome is one that you can see. Missing a hand is one that you can see or hear or whatever. Some of our disadvantages might be a little more emotional, whether we have the ability to persist through failure and so on. But obviously, these guys also had that ability to persist through failure. So let's take like the first guy as an example, Tim Howard, Tourette syndrome, OCD. What happened there?
So he's born, and early on in his life, he realizes that he can't not pick up things on the way to school every day. Rocks, dirt, flowers, anything, his backpack.
Is that a biological disorder, or is there some psychological thing happening?
I think it's more biological. So, quite honestly, he had a mild version of it, but to him, it did not feel mild. So he couldn't stop touching things and picking things up. And
what if he did? Like, what if he went to school and he just held on, he strapped his hands to his body and he couldn't pick it up?
He tried that and tried to force himself that because it's what kid wants to stand out in general. And this kind of way is really uncomfortable. So he tried that. He just couldn't. He couldn't. He did as much as he could. And so he had both Tourette's and OCD. What he found was, well, first off, there were the kids that teased him and picked on him and that kind of thing. But he dealt with that. And he had other things, too. His mother was white and his father was black. And they asked him why his skin was dark. And he didn't really think of himself as having kind of dark skin relative to his friends. And he said, oh, I just came back from Florida. So he had to deal with other kind of things, too. But early on, what I found fascinating, and it's true of a lot of the stars we write about, is that he he saw his disability as an advantage, or he came to see it as such. At first, it clearly wasn't. But when he was diagnosed, the doctor kind of said, well, some people who have Tourette's have this hyper-focus, and that's what it turns out with him. So in a game, he wasn't drifting. His mind wasn't drifting. He was focused more than any kid on the field. Now, it helped that he was bigger and faster than almost everyone out there. He was a just remarkable athlete, and he could have gone into any kind of sport instead of, you know, leading the United States and as a goalie. He could have done other kinds of things. But
so to be clear, he was a goalie for soccer?
Yes. Yeah, for those who don't know, he kind of had this remarkable World Cup, the most recent World Cup, where he didn't lead them to the champion, the victory in the end, but in defeat, he played probably the best World Cup game in history, and he was just playing out of his mind, just crazy, kind of saves left and right, and to the point where afterwards on Twitter, people were joking, wow, Tim Howard could have saved my parents' marriage, kind of thing, they're making all these jokes on what he could have saved, because he saved everything. But what I found fascinating is that the doctor had predicted, and he was right, that it could be a positive. So he had this hyper-focus and it helped him in life. So that's another theme of the book where that's the thing I think that surprised me the most. A lot of these stars, you look at like a guy like Jim Abbott, who was born with one hand and went through his own difficulties, but they came to see their disability or their difference or their challenge as a positive, not as a negative, which I found kind of fascinating and impressive.
Well, okay, Jim Abbott, by the way, that one blows me away more than perhaps any other athlete in the book. So he's a baseball player, he's a pitcher, he has one hand. A pitcher has to throw, catch, field, throw, you know, do all these things with the hand. He has to have a glove on and he has to have the glove off in one play. How did he do that to be as good or better than? I mean, he was the best amateur baseball player in the country, right? And then he was a pro baseball player. So how was he able to do that to be the best?
Not only that, the thing that I find remarkable is not only was he a great pitcher, he actually fielded his position well, and he was a gold glove winner. In other words, you would think with one hand, okay, he could pitch with that one hand, but if the ball is hit back to him, there's no way he's going to be able to field this thing. And in truth, he became better than everybody else. And to me, there's sort of a lesson there that when you have no other option, your back's against the wall, you got to figure things out. And he had to figure things out. So early on in his life, all the Little League teams, the coaches, saw that weakness, that he only had one hand, and they said, okay, we're going to take advantage. And they had their kids bunt on him. So bunt the ball, which was would force him to run, pick it up somehow, or field it, and then somehow go from the glove to the hand and throw it. And you wouldn't think it would be possible. And early on, it was really difficult for him. But with enough practice, over and over again in his backyard. He taught himself how to feel that position better than his rivals. So it got to the point where there was a really high-pressure series in Cuba against the Cuban national team, amateur in name only. They were really professionals. And the guy who led off the game, and this is in front of, I think it was 30,000 screaming fans, and they were all staring at his hands, and he felt it. Jim Abbott felt their eyeballs focused on him, and they were saying things and making fun and laughing at his hands. And here he is, first pitch, and this speedster bunts on him in front of the whole country, and he's got to field a position, and he runs, fields it, throws the guy out, and he could sense, I'm not sure how he did it, but he could sense that the crowd had turned and was backing him and was really impressed by him. So just practice over and over again, because he had no other choice. He wanted to be a ball player. He wanted to be a pitcher. You got to field a position if you're a pitcher. So he forced himself to become a great fielder despite his disability.
But let's drill down on that a second, because let's say another person's a professional athlete, so they're both pros, they both know how to practice, they both know how to persist with failure, and they're professionals. If I'm that other professional and I have both hands, and this is just totally a naive question, and I practice over and over again fielding as a pitcher, won't I do better than the guy who doesn't have, who's missing a hand?
Yes. If you focus on that one area of the game, you will be better than everybody else, right? So somebody else could have done that. I guess with that extra time, they were focusing on other kind of things. But
like pitching faster or learning a curveball or whatever?
I guess, right. So Jim had to focus on fielding his position, so he became better than everyone else. I thought you were actually going to make the point that for every one of these guys, there's somebody else who maybe focused and practiced and wasn't able to be as successful. And that would be the criticism of the theme, that for that there are other people, these are the outliers. And you could always make that argument. So I would...
I see. So the question really is, like a lot of people have disabilities, they don't all become superstars, and you lucked into the 12 people with some form of disability who became superstars.
Exactly. It's the same criticism you can make of Gladwell stuff or even my earlier book. So I wrote The Greatest Trade Ever. Well, okay, for every one of those, as you know, for every one of those guys, there are other guys who were smart and hardworking and just didn't do The Greatest Trade Ever. But to me, it's not so much... To me, there's still lessons to be learned from these outliers, and that's the point of our book, that, yeah, maybe we all can't be Jim Abbott and field our position like a Gold Glove winner and throw a no-hitter, but we can still learn some of the perseverance and the hyper-focus and the resilience of these guys.
Well, you know, and it's funny, there are common themes throughout all of these, and we could talk about it now, but maybe we'll talk about a few others, and then I'll bring it up.
Sure.
Let's talk about LeBron James. What was, for him, again, part of the problem in his childhood was kind of a broken home, moving from home to home, switching from school to school. So he was never really able to have friends. He was never able to really kind of settle down and develop what he was good at least at a very young age. And then how did he overcome that? And this is to your point earlier, is it simply because he was just... became the biggest human on the planet and the biggest, strongest, fastest human on the planet, and that's what helped him more than anything?
Yeah, it helped. But early on in his life, he was born, the family was sort of middle class, beautiful home in Ohio. But his grandmother, it was his grandmother's home, a beautiful old home. But his grandmother passed away early on. His mother was quite young, as you mentioned, a teenager, and they really couldn't keep the home. And they ended up, between the ages of 5 and 8, LeBron James moved 12 times. And just to think about that as a kid with no roots like that, it's pretty daunting start to your life. And what happened with him is, first of all, as you suggest, he grew into just an enormous and skilled being. He could have played, football, tight end. Everyone always says he could have been a superstar in all kinds of sports. He's a phenomenal athlete and specimen. But beyond that, a coach found him, a local coach, and became his kind of father figure. And what I often hear as we're talking to people a little bit about the book is there are these local volunteer coaches around the country, and they serve to some extent as proxies for missing fathers to an extent that you wouldn't necessarily imagine. These people are just sort of volunteering their time, and they take kids under their wing. And this kid, clearly, LeBron James was a sad kid. You could see him. He was sad, and the kid and the coaches and the people, parents, picked up on that. And this coach took him under his wing and taught him and gave him some stability. And he still loved his mother, and he still loves his mother and owes a lot to her. But thank God for these people that are looking out for the youth.
Yeah, so, and then he, as you mentioned, he grew pretty tall. Like, he's 6'8". He grew that way very young. So clearly he was going to shine as an athlete, but do you think he would not have shined if not for this sort of father figure? Oh, but the great thing about this coach too, and this is kind of a theme throughout the book, which we'll talk about more later, but this particular coach that took him under his wing and even sort of, I don't want to say adopted, but had him in his home for a couple of years, he specifically taught LeBron James, if I'm remembering correctly, to shoot left-handed as well as right-handed. And so LeBron James not only had the size and the strength, but he had this ability that many other pro basketball players don't usually get because it was drilled into him. And it seemed like a lot of these athletes had kind of an extra ability at some point drilled into them. And that almost becomes a way to balance off the handicap.
That's exactly right. So there are, he's a specimen. He's a human specimen, obviously. But there are a lot of those guys.
Did you meet him through writing this?
Not LeBron. He's one guy we didn't meet. We met all kinds of other people, but we didn't tell you he's a busy guy. But one great thing about LeBron is, listen, you go to the courts of New York City, West 4th Street, you get some specimens there too, and nothing ever happened with them. So it takes much more than physical ability, as you suggest. And yeah, this coach forced LeBron to dribble and shoot lefty at a young age. And it was at a time when LeBron wasn't thrilled to be, he thought he was doing fine with his right hand. And, you know, you look even in the NBA, you got guys who rely just on their right hand. And Latrell Sprewell, he retired a few years back, but he was only dribbled with his right hand. So you can still go far, but you can't become LeBron James without somebody pushing you. And you saw that elsewhere too with Dwayne Wade, another player we profile in the book. He had issues with his family too, and his father and his mother split up. And for a while, he was living with his mother, and she was a drug dealer. And at one point, at age of 6, the police burst into his home, put a gun to little Dwayne Wade's head, saying, "Where's your mother? She's a dealer. We have to arrest her." And she was in the bathroom using drugs. So he went through all kinds of tough times early on. But he too, I'm just trying to make the comparison, he too had somebody, and it was his father, who pulled him out of the ghetto, and he went to live with him and his half siblings in the suburbs outside Illinois, and he pushed him on the court and elsewhere, disciplined him, gave him chores. You need somebody like that. Each of these people, to some extent, either has a parent or somebody looking out for them.
Well, and with Dwayne Wade, his father also, so there are so many characters in here, I might miss and match some details, but Dwayne Wade, his father was, and I don't know sports at all, so his father was also, had a former pro player, correct?
Yeah, so he had some good bloodlines, that helps.
And specifically, though, it was interesting, because he, unlike a guy like LeBron James or many other people who eventually become pro basketball players, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, Dwayne Wade started off smaller, so he had to learn a different style of shooting than any other person who eventually became a pro basketball player, and then that was kind of pounded into him by his dad. So it's always this case of a teacher coming in, whether it's a father or coach or whatever, identifying, or a doctor, identifying what the handicap is and how we can build a skill that, you know, sort of diffuses the effect of the handicap. So in Dwayne Wade's case is releasing the ball slightly earlier for the shoot, which ultimately made him more accurate as he grew taller.
That was actually Steph Curry. There are some things that's a good point. It is a good point. Right. So Steph Curry, if we can segue to Steph Curry.
Yes.
So Stephen Curry, who's the MVP of the NBA and just a remarkable, unbelievable athlete, he was very small growing up, and he was okay player, was a pretty good player, but he was shooting way too far down below. And his father said, if you want to go anywhere, and his father was the former pro, he said, you're going to have to shoot over your head. And he forced him, and it was a summer through a full of tears. So it was a difficult summer. And he forced him to shoot not only over his head, but as you suggest, a unique way of shooting, where instead of most people shoot at the top of their jump, he developed a shot on the way up, and it made for a perfect arc. And I don't know why more people don't shoot that way, but it made for a beautiful arc where it's easier to shoot that way. But the same kind of thing where And it's a good point that almost everybody in the book had some setback. Just forget about all the things we write about, family issues and poverty and racism and physical issues. But you had some issue even in your ability to play sports, and there was someone pushing them, as opposed to there's a real criticism of how ball players develop today, especially in basketball. And it's why American ball players, while they're still dominant, increasingly we're going to Europe because they're forced to learn more skills. And because we indulge our players too often in America. So a kid's really good and he's only good with his right hand, but he's scoring 20, 30 a game. Let him be, forget indulgent, we let him cut through school and cut corners. But these players, luckily enough, LeBron James, Steph Curry, Dwayne Wade, and others had someone in their life telling them, well, yeah, you're good just doing whatever you're doing, but you're not going to get to the next level or the level after that without learning how to dribble with your left hand and shoot with your left hand or shoot in a different way on the way up, that kind of thing. So it is interesting. You need someone forcing you to get out of your comfort zone.
So let's talk about some of the others. I'm gonna kind of just thumb through.
Sure.
Like Althea Gibson, you know, this is a tennis player from the 40s, kind of blazed the way for players as good as Venus Williams and Serena Williams. Tell me a little about her story.
Yeah, so Althea Gibson, she grew up, and this is an earlier period. She's one person we kind of go back in history because she was such a trailblazer. She grew up, I believe it was the 50s, and she encountered real racism. And then when she became good, no one really thought she should get a shot at things like the Wimbledon. And she got some surprising support from people in the tennis world, colleagues, competitors, and others. But it did take a while for her to break down the barriers. And what her approach was, and she got criticized for it a little bit for blending in a little too much, but she learned to control her temper. She had a fierce temper growing up, and she cut school and got reprimanded and got tossed out of school and really saw things her own way, didn't want to really compromise. And over time, she realized that it won't work like that. So she learned how to control herself, a little bit like Jackie Robinson to some extent, and becoming a role model. And that was a way for society to accept her, and then eventually she triumphed.
And how did she do it?
Well, to some extent, she was a natural a star, but a lot of it was...
Which occurs with a lot of them, but a lot of people are naturals. Like you say, you know, I pass West 4th Street on 6th Avenue, and those basketball players are pro-level basketball players. What separates them from the ones who actually go on to become pros? Like,
exactly.
What separates the strong amateur from the pro, in your opinion? Because this is related to who also overcomes a disability versus those who don't.
That's exactly right. So to me, at least from the people that we profiled and spoke to in the book, it's an ability to handle setbacks and to be resilient and to ignore these things and to learn from them and to actually turn them into positives. It's a remarkable thing to do, to be able to have a setback and deal with it. So she lost a lot of early tournaments, Althea Gibson, and she dealt with racism and people screaming at her and cursing at her, calling her names, but she was able to deal with it. She handled it calmly, learned from her setbacks. And
so learning from the setbacks, that's really key. So what do you think happens? I keep bringing up 4th Street since you bring it up. Again, anybody visiting New York, it's a pleasure to, it's like a pro basketball team right on the street there.
Yeah.
But what are they not overcoming setbacks in their lives, or what's going on?
Listen, I'm not a sociologist. I haven't interviewed them, but my sense from speaking to the athletes in our book who did succeed, and from getting a sense that I've played a little bit ball. I'm a short Jewish guy, but I spent years playing.
So Harlem Globetrotters for you, yeah, and not you know,
more
basketball.
More Washington Generals. But I did play against a lot of these guys, and they've got remarkable talent. And yeah, that is the difference, where they had the talent, but there was some setback, and they had some falling out with a coach, and someone gave them a hard time, and some coach didn't give them enough respect. And for whatever reason, they didn't persevere, and you see this perseverance from the guys in our book, which I find remarkable. And it's not to say that I've got that. You know, I part of the reason I write these kind of books is I want to learn from them too and become more like them and handle setbacks. And I think we all come. That's why. Yeah, this is a book for young people, especially who like sports, but it's for anyone. They're the lessons that they're life lessons, I think, and I try to learn them myself.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. let's talk about Shane Battier for a second, because I find even as a writer, some of the things I've learned in writing are similar to what he learned in basketball.
So it's maybe, interesting.
Yeah, so, and I'll make the comparison once you tell a little more of the story of him.
Shane's a fascinating story to me because someone encouraged me to speak with him, and I know a little bit about sports, and to me, he was the least likely to be a candidate for this book because he had success his whole life, it seemed like. From a young age, he was the high school player of the year. In college, he won the championship a few times. In the NBA, he won the championship a few years. He grew up with two loving parents in the suburbs of Michigan. So what kind of challenge is there to overcome? So I was really skeptical when I started speaking with him. I was polite, but I was a little skeptical. And then I heard his story. And to me, it's really interesting because it shows you that stuff's going on inside everyone's life, and you don't realize what's going on and the challenges and the stuff they're dealing with. So Shane Battier on the surface looked like somebody who had everything going for him, but he didn't see it that way. So what he saw was, yeah, he grew up in the suburbs of Michigan in a predominantly, and it was a mixed family. His father was black and his mother was white. So he grew up in this nice, well-to-do area, but all the people in his neighborhood and his school saw him as a black kid. And I wouldn't say they teased him, but they made him feel uncomfortable sometimes. So he didn't really fit in. And partly he'll admit it was partly himself. And then because he was a great basketball player, he would go into the inner city, Detroit, AAU games. And he said, finally, somewhere I can fit in with my, you know, people who play basketball and I'm black. And he'd go in there and they'd say, oh, here comes the white kid from the suburbs with the nice sneakers and the nice shorts. And he was just wearing, you know, stuff like you and I, our parents got you some sneakers. And maybe they were new, whatever. They were nice sneakers and shorts, but they didn't overdo it. But he couldn't fit in either world. And he grew up like that. He grew up unable to fit in the white world or the black world. And back then, I guess maybe it was a little more uncommon to have mixed parents, mixed race parents. So to him, to Shane Battier, he grew up not being able to fit in. And at one point, so he felt bad about it, but then at one point, something turned on and turned. And he decided to say, you know what? Oh, I'm a runt. I'm somebody who doesn't fit in either world. I'm going to make that into a positive. And that affected the way he played the game. So if anybody, any of your audience, remembers how he played, he was a fascinating guy because he would do all the ugly parts of the game really well. So he would take a charge defensively. He'd be sprawled out on the court after someone runs him over, but he caused a foul on the opposing star. And he always would guard the opposing star. Lots of people, if you're a superstar, in the NBA, you don't want to guard the other superstar. You'll look bad. You'll spend too much time playing defense. You'll exert energy.
Like Michael Jordan doesn't play defense.
No, well, he was a great defensive player, but ideally these guys want to focus on offense. You look at James Harden. James Harden on the Houston Rockets, he goes through the motions on defense. He's amazing on offense. He goes through the motions on defense. So Shane Battier said, you know, I don't care what people think about me. I don't fit in either world anyway, so I'm going to do things like make an extra pass and guard the best guy on defense and come off the bench. One time he was starting the NBA, and no one asks to go to the bench. No one. That's like admitting you're mediocre, you're inferior. And he said, you know what? I'm going to go to the bench because that way I can guard. There's a way to do it. For whatever reason, it helped the team. It helped the team. So he, because of how he grew up and insecurity he grew up with, he eventually came around to the view that I don't care what people think about me and how I look, and it helped his game. So I find that kind of story interesting.
Yeah, and there was a couple things interesting. So he became very good at defense, meaning you don't really see him as the guy who shot 40 points in a game or this or that, but he was the one you could put against Kobe Bryant.
Exactly.
The best basketball player maybe in history, particularly at shooting near the net and so on, and he would be able, he's the one guy who'd be able to defend against Kobe Bryant, but he did it with an interesting style. He knew he couldn't compete against Kobe Bryant at the net, so what did he do?
So he did this thing. It's fascinating, and you wonder why more people don't do it, and I think the answer is
because, by the way, you've just said that twice, so it's an interesting theme among these people.
Yes. And part of it is because they'll look, it's not the coolest looking. And you don't look cool doing it, so people shy away from it. So what happened was when opposing players, like a Kobe, went up especially on a fast break with the ball, and most people go up with them and try to block the shot. It's a cool thing to block a shot in the NBA or anywhere. You go on West 4th Street, you block a shot, you're the man. You've made the other guy look inferior. you've embarrassed them. Everyone loves to block a shot. I'm 5'7", and if I could block a shot, I would love to. I've had many shots of mine blocked. But so Shane Battier, he knew he couldn't block Kobe Bryant's shot, and he wasn't even going to try. What he did was, as Kobe Bryant brought the ball up to shoot it, he would jar it away. And in other words, he would stay a little bit low. He would act like he was going up with Kobe Bryant, but he would stay lower and swipe at the ball. And it really worked. And yet, again, once again, people don't do it because it looks, you could, he did this other thing where he would put his hand in Kobe's face, and he did it with other opposing shooters. And that also works too. You obscure the vision of the opposing shooter.
Yeah, why don't more people do that?
It isn't cool. It isn't a foul. It just is frowned on. Hey, dude, stop. What's with the hand in the face? It's just old school. Like, guys in the 50s and 60s did that a lot. Like, I can remember my uncle doing that kind of thing. And it gets in the head of the players, but they don't do that as much. I mean, some players will do it, but it's better to go up and try to block it or steal it. But they don't put their hands in the opposing guy's face. Because and Kobe got upset. Kobe hated going up against Shane Battier. We write about it in the book. So you don't win any friends doing that kind of stuff. But he didn't care. Again, he grew up without many friends, so he didn't care.
So I think this idea of not caring is really important. So whether you have one hand and everyone's kind of making fun of you, or whether you have Tourette syndrome and everyone's waiting to see if you're going to like break out in a bunch of, I don't know, curses or whatever, having an ability to not care what people think, which allows you to sort of look at the game differently, so that you can develop skills that other people are not developing. Like, if you're already sort of on the outskirts, on the fringes of your peer group, if you could be on the fringes even further with a skill set you develop as taught by a teacher. All these guys had a teacher which helped them develop these skills. It seems like there's a common theme here of and then, of course, persistence through, you know, you learn very quickly to persist because you had to persist on a personal level when you were younger. So maybe that persistence translated into the athletics.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's also, when you talk about persistence, you know, it's cliche, practice, but these guys had remarkable persistence. So there's a guy, Serge Ibaka, we write about in the book, and he's from the Congo, poor guy. He grew up so poor that he didn't really have sneakers. So on the court, they would, whatever sneakers, shoes they had would get worn out. So they would have to reinforce the bottoms of their soles with cardboard, he and his friends. And his mother passed away of cancer at an early age. His father was a political prisoner. And he realized early on that basketball was his ticket out. So he started, and he really emphasized this when he spoke to me and my boys. He put his arm around my boys, and he emphasized as a life lesson the importance of focus. In other words, his friends were out partying. And we're wearing nice clothing sometimes. On Saturday night, they were going out and they would make fun of him. Oh, Serge, you're too poor to come out with us. And he could have gone out with them. And he liked girls and everything, all that kind of stuff. But he said, no, that stuff will be there for me later. And I'm not advocating, you know, abstinence until later. But I'm suggesting that.
Got to be a superstar before you fool around with girls.
Exactly. No. But he really emphasized, that was the one thing he emphasized with my kids, is the importance of not getting distracted by things. He said to my sons, video games will be there later, girls will be there later, all that stuff that distracts you will be there later. And again, not every kid can just focus on whatever it is, math or sports or whatever, solely. But there's something to be said for the explanation as to why a guy like Serge Ibaka, yeah, I think he's 6'11", and he runs like a guy who's 5'11", whatever. But beyond that, there are a lot of guys like that. Beyond that, he had this ability to focus on sports, and it helped him.
So a lot of these people in the book, your kids ended up meeting. What do you think their takeaways were through the process of writing this book? And you list them as co-authors.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What were their takeaways? And by the way, congratulations to you as a parent, like, you know, making your kids co-authors and using that as an excuse to just call up every athlete you wanted to call up and introduce them to them. Because we all know it's just an excuse to call up everybody you want to call up and ask them any question you want.
Yeah.
Heck, it's why I called you.
Well, the funny thing is, I'm at the Wall Street Journal, and I've written a couple books. I'm used to people wanting to talk to me. When it comes to the sports world, It was less easy than I thought it would be. So it took a little more persistence
because
on our part.
Because they're huge and they're busy.
Yeah, some of them, believe it or not, said, okay, or their agent said, well, what are you paying me to talk to you? Well, how much? I had to explain to them, first of all, the economics of how little we make, and second of all, how unethical it would be. And they came around to it. But it did help having my kids, not as a prop, but because a lot of these guys are a little bit jaded at this point. I've talked to so many adult journalists, sports journalists, they're kind of sick of them all. But you have a kid, you want to impart something. There are a lot of people, Serge Ibaka, Jacques Demers, the coach, who I think had an unbelievable story. R.A. Dickey, the pitcher, sat with my kids and me in the Yankee Stadium dugout for over an hour before the game. So they were eager to share some life lessons with young people. And that really kind of blew me away. It was really impressive to me. So these guys are, you know, multimillionaires and they've been written up everywhere. But to sit down and spend the extra time to impart some life lessons, I thought that was pretty impressive. I'm not sure. I think I've forgotten your question, actually.
Well, what was the takeaway from your
for those kids? So they came into it. My youngest is an autograph hound, and he really kind of just wanted some autographs. And my eldest is a bookworm, and he wanted to be part of a book project. But slowly but surely, we all became sort of blown away by these stories. And they came out of it just completely with a different perspective. So again, at first it was sort of, all right, I want to meet some players. By the end, they were amazed. They were really impressed by each of the stories because they're all so different, and yet what they've overcome is just so dramatic. So, you know, I live in suburbia. I live in New Jersey. So there's not many setbacks to my kids. You know, they've got their own setbacks. Everyone's got a difference. And again, I said my son and
which is an important point. Everyone's got a difference. Just because you weren't born with Tourette's or only one hand, everyone's got something to overcome, and it's sort of like isolating that, and it seems like an important theme is finding out also what advantages can come from it.
I totally agree, and that to me is the theme of the book. So yeah, we weren't, you know, born in the Congo like Serge Ibaka, but you know, there's a kid in the next town over who unfortunately took his life recently because of the stress of taking the ACTs and the SATs, and it's you know, it's haunted all of us as parents in the area, and so everyone's dealing with something. That kid was obviously dealing with something. My son's a junior in high school, and it's a stressful year, and I'm sure a lot of the parents out there can relate. The whole college process nowadays, and it's more competitive than ever. So everyone's got their own stuff and their own differences. That's our contention. So that's kind of why we wrote this book.
And have you seen improvement in your kids' performance after hanging out with all these, you know, elite athletes?
It's early. No, they're pretty well-adjusted kids, but there is, I think it's going to be a life lesson for them.
Kind of a reminder that, hey, yeah, even with this setback, with persistence, focus, a good teacher, and maybe exploring what other skills I can learn that nobody else has learned, this might propel them forward.
I think very much. And that last point is a really good one. It's all about, you know, in economics, it's competitive advantage. What can you do better than other people? Mm-hmm. And as you suggest, so Shane Battier, I found his competitive advantage or comparative advantage. I always forget which is the one my brother teaches business school. But same kind of thing. He became somebody specializing in things that others didn't care about. And you see that throughout the book. Again, there's this guy, Jacques Demers, who was a coach, and he never learned how to read or write. He was functionally illiterate, and he had to hide it. To me, that's the most, as an adult, remarkable story in some ways, that the guy, but he came up with all these stratagems, these tricks to trick people into thinking he could read and write. So he had to adjust on the fly. And I don't know, he became a coach who specialized in being a player's coach and being friendly and encouraging, because he had a tough childhood. So they all found their niche, as you suggest.
And why would that be good? Like, sometimes being too friendly to the athletes, if you're a coach, could backfire on you.
It could. I think when it's genuine, I think they sense. They didn't know his background. So just to take a step back, here's a guy who grew up and he was physically abused by his father. Daily. Now he'd come home and just get beaten up by his father. And his mother he'd go to school every day and his mother was getting beat up by the father as well. And he couldn't focus in school. All he could think about was his father and what he was doing to his mother at home. He loved his mother dearly. And he literally could not learn. He never learned how to read or write because he just missed that those first few years when he couldn't focus, and it hurt him his whole life and no one really helped him. And he became a coach. Here he is in the NHL. And he can't read or write. So he had to come up with these amazing tricks. So he would he would start wearing glasses even though he didn't need to. And then he would, that way, when people came to him and said, oh, can you sign this? And he'd say, oh, he'd fumble and he couldn't find it. I can't find my glasses. Oh, can you sign it for me? Or he would carry newspapers under his arm and to suggest that he could read, and he didn't. He would watch CNN a lot, so he was well-informed. All these kind of things. He would order the special every time in the restaurant. So he to me, he's an example of adjusting on the fly and figuring things out. And eventually he came out of the closet and owned up to it. And to me, it's a pretty moving chapter.
And then how did he adjust his coaching style because he couldn't read?
Okay. Thanks for getting me back on. So, I think people sensed. So his players sensed that it was genuine. What he tried to do is, I don't think it was not a conscious thing, but because he was treated so poorly by his father, he decided to be just the friendliest guy. And again, I don't think it was a decision. He became the friendliest coach, the friendliest person. And his players appreciated that. So it was genuine. They didn't know what had happened in his background at all. They had no sense. But the fact that he went through what he did as a child and he became this supportive, encouraging, friendly coach, I think is partly because of what he dealt with. And it wasn't a conscious decision, but it evolved that way.
And so they didn't, a lot of times a friendly coach, the athletes, the players will take advantage of the friendliness, even if it's genuine.
Like, yeah.
How is he able to kind of just still firmly coach and come up with the best coaching strategies and so on, particularly given that he couldn't read, histories or from other coaches and so on?
Well, he was a great motivator, a sharp guy, smart guy.
I guess he had to be more verbal in terms of the motivation, so that maybe helped him.
Yeah. Also, he was lucky to get into situations where there were kind of turnaround situations with pretty good talent, but they needed somebody to be a supportive. But he also, quite honestly, like many coaches, you're hired to be fired. So it's not like he lasted at the same team for a decade or so. He, that style, as you suggest, doesn't last forever. So he won Coach of the Year back-to-back, first person ever in the NHL. So he had a lot of success. But eventually, you're right. Being the friendly, supportive guy doesn't always work long term.
So what did you learn? So you're a Wall Street Journal writer, author. This has been a very different book from you, although you have examined in both with Frackers and The Greatest Trade Ever peak performance, particularly in the areas of finance and industry. But what did you learn from this?
So,
like, what's our takeaway? What the person sitting at home, which is a person just like you and me, say, what can we take away from this?
So, as you suggest, I am drawn to characters who achieve dramatically against all odds. And you could say the first, John Paulson, I wrote the book, The Greatest Trade Ever. So that was a guy who made $20 billion over 2 years, and he wasn't betting against the housing bubble, and he wasn't even a housing guy. He was a merger guy. What does he know about housing? And yet he did it, and the other people in the book as well. And The Frackers is about people who saw something that the oil and gas giants didn't, that we in this country can find a lot of oil and gas, and the experts dismissed them and they proved them wrong. So I am drawn to that theme. And here too, a lot of the people are unlikely success stories. And to me, that's one of the lessons, that from a disadvantage can come advantage. And that's one thing I was most surprised by, how each of them, unprovoked, kind of said, Greg, I came to see my difference or my disadvantage, my challenge, my difference as an advantage, something that actually helped me. And I never would have thought that. I thought it was all about persistence. And persistence and practice is a key theme of this book. But it's also seeing, and I think you've probably seen in your own life, I know a little bit about what you've accomplished and your setbacks too. Maybe that helps you become successful. Some of those disadvantages and those setbacks aren't just setbacks. They actually, and it takes time and you don't see it right away, but those setbacks actually help you. They don't hurt you. They actually help you long term. And there's this big theme now about grit and all that kind of stuff. It's the same kind of thing where, and a lot of us have as parents, want our kids to be able to overcome things, and they don't have so many challenges and kind of suburbia and all that kind of thing. And that is an emphasis I think we have of trying to teach that you can see a disadvantage as a positive.
A disadvantage is a positive, which helps you kind of traverse a bigger gap, say, than the regular player going to pro. You have to actually persist further distance, which in some ways gives you more quote-unquote hours of practice or whatever. But then there's always this interesting thing where they all developed skills to the periphery of the main of what were considered to be the core skills of the game or the sport, whatever sport they were involved in. And I found that to be fascinating because these sports, you think, okay, we all know the skills that needed to be learned. Like basketball, you need to learn dribbling and shooting. But then it turns out there's these other periphery skills that these guys somehow had a special talent at learning, perhaps because they were always on the periphery.
I like that theme. Yeah, these are people who were outsiders, who didn't come easy to them early on or even later in life. A guy like R.A. Dickey, we didn't really talk about him too much, but he's a guy who was abused sexually by a female and a boy in the neighborhood and grew up in really difficult circumstances. He had to break into abandoned homes just for somewhere to sleep. He would break in and then roll up a sweatshirt and put his head down to sleep at night. He just needed somewhere to sleep. And then later on, he signs about to sign a million dollar contract to pitch for the Texas Rangers. And they notice something in a picture that he's missing a ligament. And it turns out, and then they withdraw that contract. So, but it's that same kind of theme where he developed into a knuckleball pitcher and found success that way. So same kind of theme as you suggest. It's a peripheral kind of skill. No one throws the knuckleball. Very few people do. A couple
is it hard?
People. It's hard to learn. It's hard to master. There's no one to teach you.
What happens in a knuckleball? Like the ball goes all around?
Yeah, well, it's supposed to drop and there's no spin to it. And each one throws a little bit different. He throws a little bit harder than some other people. So it's hard to master, but it's just so unusual. But it's the same kind of thing. It's a peripheral skill, as you suggest. And he saw no one else pitching it, and he had no other options, so he decided to master it.
You know, it's funny. It reminds me of in the chess world, Bobby Fischer, who's considered many people consider him the greatest chess player ever. When he was younger, I mean, he suffered from mental illness all his life, probably starting from when he was at a young age. His dad left at an early age. His mom was always at work. He didn't go to school, so he was just at home all day studying chess. And then at one point, he wasn't necessarily known as the most talented young player, and then he kind of disappeared from tournament play for a little bit when he was 12 years old, and he did this intense study of games played in the 1800s. So he became better than anyone else at knowing every game from the 1800s. And he tried to improve on the play of all these games by world-class players in the 1800s. And so when he came back into play, he would play these openings, you know, the chess, the beginning of a game is called the opening. He would play these openings that many players had already forgotten about or had considered too obscure or too simplistic to master, but he had mastered them and kind of improved them. And, you know, he then won the U.S. Championship 13-0, the first player to do a total shutout in the U.S. Championship. Sort of reminds me of that story a little bit.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And again, he took advantage when other people didn't necessarily, other people wouldn't, but he took advantage of a setback or used the setback. And you've talked about that in your own work, about the importance of taking a step back when you've, you know, down and out and you've got no options. Well, you can figure out some options and not to give up and to try to adjust on the fly. And it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do to have that self-confidence and but that self-resilience and being able to turn on and take a step back and try to figure out what are your options here? What can you do better than other people? There are some things that everyone can do.
So Greg Zuckerman, this is probably the one sports-related book I will read this year, but it was worth it. Like, I'm not a big sports fan at all, but I was fascinated by each of these stories. Rising Above, How 11 Athletes Overcame Challenges in Their Youth to Become Stars. Really, like, just a fascinating approach to athletics that I had never read before. And it's not only by you, but it's by Elijah and Gabriel Zuckerman. So I like how you brought the family into it. It must have been a bonding experience.
Oh, yeah, it was a great project, yeah.
And so good luck, and I hope this book does really well.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com. And get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, thanks for listening. Listen, I have a big favor to ask you, and it'll only take 30 seconds or less, and it would mean a huge amount to me. If you like this podcast, please let me know. Please let the team I work with know. Please let my guests know. And you can do this easily by subscribing to the podcast. It's probably the biggest favor you could do for me right now, and it's really simple. Just go to iTunes, search for the James Altucher Show, and click subscribe. Again, it will only take you 30 seconds or less, and if you subscribe now, it will really help me out a lot. Thanks again.